Hey, good afternoon, Juneau. It's just about 10 seconds before 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore, your host today for a Juneau afternoon. I've got a great lineup of guests today. We're going to meet a faculty member out at the University of Alaska Southeast from the art department. Peter Dalthirk will be with us. Betsy Brenneman will drop in to tell us about the Juneau After School Coalition's BAM Activities Program. We are expecting a major turnout tonight for the Back to School Poetry Slam at Thunder Mountain High School, and some folks will be here to tell us about that. And we'll be talking to Colonel Dave Fabian of the U.S. Army Historical Foundation. They've received a Rasmussen grant to start a new historical museum of the Army in the United States. It'll be the first time there is one of those. Stay tuned for Juneau Afternoon. National Native News is next.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A tribal college professor is visiting an Ivy League school this fall. As Rhonda Lavaldo reports, the professor hopes to increase awareness about Indigenous people and issues.
Dr. Dan Wildcat teaches in natural and social sciences at Haskell Indian Nations University in Lawrence, Kansas. He's traveling more than 1,000 miles to instruct at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. Wildcat says the class he's teaching is Native Western Views of Nature.
I will be presenting the same material I present in Haskell, and we'll see. Are they up for it? Is this something that they can appreciate and wrap their mind around? Because I think there are very different worldviews that Indigenous people hold.
Vice President of Academic Affairs, Dr. Vanita Chenault, says Wildcat's opportunity is positive for all tribal colleges across the country.
I think certainly it has the potential, you know, for other tribal college faculty to serve in those roles and demonstrates the caliber of our faculty.
Even Haskell students are encouraged with Wildcat's visiting professorship. Josh Munson is in his senior year at Haskell.
Like, I view my son as like an advocate for all of us as a whole. You know, he's somebody that can speak for us and that we can have confidence in, because he is a great professor. I mean, it's pretty cool how he approaches it. He's very passionate.
Wildcat will be the Gordon Russell visiting professor at Dartmouth September through November. Dartmouth brings in a Native American scholar each year through its Native American Studies Department. This is Rhonda Lavaldo for National Native News.
The Gwich'in Steering Committee is celebrating its 25th anniversary. The group was established by Gwich'in chiefs and elders in Alaska and Canada to respond to proposed oil development in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Sarah James, chairperson of the committee, says the area includes porcupine caribou calving grounds. She says the group is dedicated to protecting the herd.
It's our way of life. It's our food on our table. It's our clothing. It's our tools. And it's our, like today, 85% of our diet, mainly from the wild animal, and most of it is caribou. And we do caribou dance. Caribou is everything to us, just like how the buffalo is to the Plains Indians. That's how it is for us.
Their work includes advocating for permanent protection through Congress. More than a dozen villages in Canada and the U.S. make up the Gwich'in Nation. To celebrate 25 years, a walk was held and a two-day celebration begins Saturday in Arctic Village, Alaska. A memorial service for a former Osage Nation chief is being held this weekend in Oklahoma. KGOU's Kirk Gwartney reports on the life of George Tall Chief.
My phone rang and I answered it, and hey, they said, hey, you're the new chief. I said, whoa, now wait a minute. I'll be over in a little bit. I said, you got to tell me a lot anyway. So I went back over, and sure enough, I'd won.
That's George Tall Chief in an online video from the Third World Newsreel talking about how he found out he would lead the Osage Nation. He served in that role from 1982 until 1990. Tall Chief died August 11th at the age of 96. His memorial service is Saturday at the Gray Horse Chapel in Fairfax, Oklahoma. Tall Chief was a proponent of the three branches of government and an early supporter of its adoption in the Osage Nation. After serving two terms as chief, he served as president of the first Osage National Council. He also spent 50 years working as an educator, teaching and coaching sports in Oklahoma, Oregon, and Idaho. Tall Chief was also inducted into the National Native American Hall of Fame and a recipient of the Peace Chief Award. For National Native News, I'm Kurt Gwartney.
During this week in 2012, landowners canceled the auction of some 2,000 acres of Black Hills land in South Dakota. The area known as Peshlaw is considered sacred by Lakota people. A nationwide campaign was held to raise money to buy the land. It was later acquired by tribes. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation, and by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 5 minutes and 40 seconds after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. We're in the middle of Juneau afternoon. In a moment, I'm going to introduce my first guest, but I thought I would tell you the information about the news, or about the weather. We're looking at it right now. Chance of rain for the afternoon, and then highs around 60. Southeast winds 5 to 15 miles per hour. And tonight, we're going to have rain this evening, and then rain late, and patchy fog late. Lows around 52, south winds 10 miles per hour. The Weather Bureau is forecasting rain for Saturday, and rain likely for Saturday night. So I think that works out to rain is pretty much what I got out of that whole thing. So my first guest is Paydar.
Yep.
Paydar Dalthorpe. And Paydar is a member of the art faculty at the University of Alaska Southeast. Been on the faculty now, I think, about 2 years, right?
Actually quite a bit longer than that.
Oh, okay.
I'm going into my sixth year
now. Oh, my heavens. Yeah. Okay. Well, we haven't had a chance to meet yet, but anyway.
Yeah, I made it down here once in the past, maybe a couple times, talked with Jeff.
Okay. So what do you bring to the art faculty? What is your area of expertise, and what are you training art students to do?
I'd say, generally speaking, my area of expertise, if you could call it that, is three dimensions. I've got backgrounds in several different disciplines, but I think what I'm trying to do is to get people to think about dimensional materials and how to put those together, how to create things that, you know, exist in the same sort of space that we exist, which I think is a little bit different than drawing or painting or photography.
On the website out at the university, one of the things that you say is that you would like to bring together the disparate art forms in some sort of blog.
Mm-hmm.
And you're working in three dimensions, but what is your interest there? What kind of thing would you envision this is what form would you envision this is taking?
Well, I can address that in a few ways. I think socially there are some art forms that are conducive to getting people together. Take ceramics, for instance. I think that there's sort of an automatic community in ceramics because
it takes more than one person to fire a kiln. So
right, right. Yeah. And typically you're making things that are used for like food service. So those things go kind of hand in hand. Whereas my experience has been that in painting or sculpture, people have a slightly different focus, and they can work a little bit more individualistically, and what I'd like to see is to have us take advantage of the space that we have there, and get people from different areas to share amongst themselves. For instance, we've been developing our metal casting capabilities, and just did the first bronze pour that I'm familiar with on UAS. At least UAS Juneau campus, I think. Mm-hmm. They've done that in Sitka. So that's the sort of thing that takes cooperation. It takes a group of people, and having a bunch of fire doesn't hurt either in terms of getting people excited. In another sense, I think of these art forms, like specifically what I'm teaching, sculpture and printmaking, and I got a fair amount of background with mold making, so I'm thinking about using the absence of something to create information. So, for instance, if I'm making a mold, I'm basically creating a cavity that I'll then fill with something to produce an object. And you can say something similar about printmaking. You're removing information from a plate or a block and then using that to create information. So I see those as nearly the same sort of thing. Like, mold making is kind of like printmaking and vice versa. And then I'm also looking to see what that sort of approach can do in a more philosophical sense. Like, what's the nature of absence, and like, where do things come from? And so I've been looking to incorporate scientific themes into artwork, both my own and trying to encourage students to think about similar things.
How does the scientific theme tie to the negative space idea? Did you mean to tie those ideas together?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. Okay. There's some reason to believe that that, for instance, the universe formed itself from a complete absence of anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not a scientist. And I know the people that are still struggling with this idea.
But dark matter, I think, is very closely related to what you're talking about, because that's one of the big scientific puzzles right now about the universe.
That's true. I'm talking about the very beginning of what happened before the Big Bang. And there's a current theory that there actually was absolutely nothing, and that nothingness was unstable enough that it created something out of itself. So that complete absence basically turned into everything. I'm still working with that idea, but I think that appeals to me because it's something that can be measured, and experiments can be done, and it looks like that's a pretty plausible explanation. So what I get out of that is that it encourages cross-pollination of ideas, like with people in other areas. I think that it's not real helpful to make art about art.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there's a lot of worthy stuff out there that can be, a lot of worthy ideas that can be advocated for.
Peter Dalthorn, one of the courses that you teach at the university has to do with career development for artists.
Mm-hmm.
Did you choose to teach that? Was that something that you wanted to do?
Yeah, that's something that wasn't here before I got here, and based on my experience in applying to graduate school, applying to shows, I basically built the curriculum around those ideas. And when I was going to school, we didn't have such a class, so you basically had to grab a professor and have them kind of help you through the process, mm-hmm. which I think was, at the time, probably the most difficult single task that I had to achieve in my undergraduate years. So I think it's immensely helpful, whether you're planning on going to a graduate school or going to a residency program or applying for a job. It basically gets you to put all your stuff together, high-quality images. It also helps you to think about what it is that you're doing. I've actually been pretty grateful that I've been put on the spot at times and forced to organize my ideas about what it is that I'm doing, and this is an opportunity to do that. And it culminates with a public presentation at the end of the semester. So students will give a 15 to 20 minute multimedia presentation out at the Egan Lecture Hall about their work and their plans and what they're going to do. And you can actually find those on YouTube. I've recorded those and posted them.
Mm. Classes are starting in a couple of weeks. What you teach in this term?
I'm teaching printmaking, sculpture, and the career development class.
Okay. Well, Peter Dalthart, thank you so much for coming down, for sharing a little sort of an insight into the inner workings of the art department at the University of Alaska Southeast.
You're welcome. It's been my pleasure.
Minutes after 3 o'clock.
This is Bird Note. Nature is evolving constantly around us. Dr. Mike Webster of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology describes an example of rapid evolution and adaptation from the world of birds.
A beautiful example of rapid bird evolution that we see happening today is change in migratory routes. A very nice study of European blackcaps, which is an old world warbler, has shown that in the past, these birds would breed in Germany during the summer and then migrate down to Spain for the winter. But about 20 or 30 years ago, some of these blackcaps started going to England and found warm temperatures there, so due to climate change, and a lot of bird feeders with food because the Brits were feeding their local birds. And so these black caps started going there, and over just the course of 20 or 30 years, we've actually seen genetic change in the population so that these birds are genetically programmed to migrate to England rather than to Spain. And their bills are changing shape as well, probably because they are finding a very different food resource in England than they had in Spain, namely all those bird feeders.
The survival of birds depends on their ability to adapt to a changing world. There's more to this story at birdnote.org.
Minutes after 3 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News. Pat Moore, your host today for Juneau Afternoon. My next two guests are going to be partnering to put together a poetry slam tonight at Thunder Mountain High School. Pat McClear and Kate Laster, right?
Correct.
Hey,
hello.
I did it good. Welcome.
Yeah.
Well.
Yeah.
So
thank you.
Now you have to speak in rhyme for the rest of
oh
the
day. Oh my gosh, or iambic pentameter.
Sure.
I'm excited. I love challenges like that. I've always been free verse, but I love them all.
There you go.
I love them all. It's my time to rhyme.
The voice you're hearing, of course, is Kate Laster. And
you're
known, I think, in town for in participating in these sorts of things, aren't you?
Yeah, yeah,
your
I try. I mean,
procedure.
I'm part of the board of this amazing Ushkana Dei Poetry Slam, and
yes.
It's an amazing group, and it's a great town to be known in for. So tonight is going to be spectacular, and just again, it's happening at Thunder Mountain High School, and I just think this is the blowout for Friday August Slam. It's going to be phenomenal. I'm not going to lie.
It sounds like I'm detecting a certain note of enthusiasm. Pat, are you kind of picking that up?
I feel those vibes are coming right across.
I love librarians.
Yeah. Well,
so,
yeah, right
people
there,
who
right
get
there.
Words.
So who thought this idea up?
Well, last year at Floyd Dryden Middle School, we had an artist in the schools program, mm-hmm. and the staff decided on spoken word would be the art form that we were looking for. And Christine Amy Erickson was the artist who was asked to mm-hmm. Work in the building. And she worked with eighth graders and she worked with sixth graders. And the culmination of her work was a poetry slam at school, which was held in the Dryden Library, so I got to be the host.
Yay.
And she brought her DJ in and rocked that library, and it was great. The enthusiasm, it was so positive. It was really a highlight of that second semester. So afterwards, Christy and I spoke, and she thought about having a one at Dryden,
yes.
and after. Late in the school year, and I just said late in the school year equals chaos with capital letters. And how about if we aim for a back to school? And everybody jumped in and said, let's do it.
All right. So you've been in session, what, a week?
With these past 4 days.
Yeah,
whoa!
Four days down. Okay. So, and this is going to be the end of this week. The students are going to be primed
tonight.
For this, right?
Well, we can hope. You know, okay. They're just... Like the end of the school year is chaotic. Oftentimes, the beginning of the year.
So here's the question: do the students hook into this?
Well, one thing that pleasantly surprised me with Christy's work at Dryden, there are some students that you go, "Oh yeah, of course, so and so's going to do it. So and so loves
the drama,
exactly."
But surprise!
Here steps up a student who I would never have imagined. That student getting up to perform in front of not only peers, but staff, parents, the whole nine yards. And that was just such a wonderful surprise.
Mm-hmm. It's true. Our name comes from the Tlingit words, parallel paths. And it's something that I think is brought here where so many people who are secretly poets, you know, with the appearance of being shy, perform, and there's all these people coming together to listen, to participate, to share something. And that's what happens. All these people from different perspectives gather together, and it gets warmer, and there's an intensity. And you said positive.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
That's what these events
absolutely.
Are. It's the friendliest competition in town.
Absolutely.
How'd you come into this, Kate?
I was actually at the first slam they did a couple of years ago.
Well,
you were always
out front with them.
I was always, but okay. I am a secretly shy person, and poetry slams are things that I have to do.
Uh-huh.
They are just magnetic to me. And I love seeing poets perform for the first time. I love seeing old pros come in, and you get every kind of level, every kind of voice, and respect for those different voices at these slams. So even if you're not a poet, it's definitely something to check out. And so many schools are participating in this.
How are you letting the students know this is going to happen?
Well, Barb Creer, who's the librarian at JD High School, she has it up on the website. She's put it on Channel 13, whatever is it, Channel 13 on cable, where you can post things that are educational in mind. You can walk down the halls of Floyd Dryden, and it's wallpapered with posters for the slam. And it's been we do an online, not an online, I'm sorry, a television news show at Dryden as well. And so the students have advertised on there, and then each teacher was asked to let the world know. So whether or not, what I'm not sure what's been going on at Thunder Mountain, but at the other two schools.
It's basically we put the bat signal up for poetry, and we've let it go, and we've hooked, I think, a lot of good people into it.
Well, Wooshkanadier now has you got a body.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's probably 100 or more people, but when you put the bat signal up, a lot of people come.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I think the problem is once you go, you're like, you know, I have to go again.
Yeah.
It's not something where you're, maybe that's not for me, maybe it's too loud, maybe it's too quiet. No, it just is a safe, comfortable, wild experience, and you want to share it. I know that's how I feel. And
that safe part, I think, was integral when Christy did the work at school, because, again, those students who may have hesitated saw what a safe environment she created, mm-hmm. and that they could risk being up there and doing personal work.
Absolutely.
And knowing that they
and
were
nobody's
going to
say,
they were going to be received in a positive
no
manner.
No booing, no hissing.
No.
Friendliest competition
no,
in town.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So how does a student get into it? If somebody wants to do this tonight,
you're going to have to be there. Because remember, Thunder Mountain High School tonight. Sign-ups start at 6:30, the slam.
No, 5:30.
5:30. You're right. Yes, oh, my gosh.
Yes.
Yeah, thank God. I just drew the poster. I didn't add the words on it.
That's 2 hours from now, so don't get this wrong.
Exactly. It's going to be hot. I have to inform y'all. It's going to be hot. Okay. Sign-ups, those go fast. Those go really fast. Again, we have two divisions. Open mic, which is perform whatever. Sans, someone else's poem. Perform some poem with someone else. You can do anything. But then the slam is totally original work, and it's competitive. And that goes for 3 rounds, and it's intense, and I get chills talking about it. Because you never know what's going to happen, except it's going to be awesome.
So you've gone through about a million of these, right?
Just a bit.
What's the wildest thing you've seen?
Wildest? Oh, my gosh. I'm thinking of a lot of slams. In Juneau, I think Juneau has one of the greatest slam communities. I love Seattle and San Francisco slam groups, but Juneau's amazing. And I remember a poet, Nathan Block, who won an amazing slam in February, tear up a poem, throw it, and keep performing it. And I just was like, what? It was starstruck. It was beautiful. It was authentic, which is strange. You know, you think it's very theatrical, but it's very genuine. But at the same time, you know, I just love seeing the same group of people perform and hear new work. We're always scrambling, trying to make new poems for the slams. You know, it's not the same stuff. It's deep.
When the slam happened this summer at the Food Truck Friday, and I was in the audience at the time, and here comes this, 9-10-year-old child, and she gets up there and she does her piece, and then here comes a 75-plus-year-old elder who got up to do her piece, and in between was a variety of youth and young adults, and I thought, this is it. This is great.
Yeah.
This is great, because all comers are welcome. Yeah. But I have a question for you.
Yeah,
on your poster, dear, it says, stay gold, stay fierce.
Oh, yes.
I had people
man.
What does that mean? And I said, well, the fierce part, let's do it. But the gold,
the only thing
I thought was Robert Frost and nothing gold can stay, so stay gold.
Oh my gosh, that reminds me of Shakespeare. Not all that glitters is gold.
Gold.
But, so many illusions. I love librarians. Stay gold, kind of keeping that heat of the summer that we get in a very ephemeral sense. We get that glint of sunlight and we have to keep it inside ourselves. ourselves when we speak up.
Okay.
But it can be interpreted however you want, Juno.
There you go.
Yeah.
Thank you.
5:30 tonight, TMHS. You got to sign up in order to be at the open mic, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to be in the competition, same thing, 5:30.
Yeah.
The event begins at? When do you need to be in the audience?
Oh, gosh. You know, I would recommend being there pretty early because stuff happens. I mean, it gets fierce. There's some preambling to it. We usually have music playing. I think coming around the open mic slot time.
Which is what time?
Six.
Okay, so
yes.
6 o'clock. And yes, this whole thing lasts until...
It can. I'm going to say it can go pretty far, but 2 hours is a good allotment.
Okay, all right.
Yeah,
Thunder Mountain High School.
Yeah, that's the place
sign
to
up,
be.
6 o'clock.
And save an afterglow. You'll have an afterglow afterwards.
Right.
So,
yeah,
thank you.
Hey, no enthusiasm about this event whatsoever.
None.
From Kate Laster and Pat McLean.
thank
you so much for coming here.
Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday, August 23rd, 2013. On this day in 1927, Nicola Sacco, a shoemaker, and Bartolomeo Vanzetti, a fish seller, were executed in Boston. The two men, Italian immigrants, had been convicted of the murders of a paymaster and his guard, robbing them of the nearly $16,000 payroll they were carrying. A few weeks later, Sacco and Vanzetti were arrested on a streetcar by a policeman who thought they looked suspicious. That September, Sacco and Vanzetti were indicted for the murders. Sacco and Vanzetti believed themselves to be victims of prejudice, anti-Italian prejudice, and many well-known artists and intellectuals demanded and campaigned for a retrial. They were unsuccessful. On August 23, 1927, 7 years after their arrest, Sacco and Vanzetti were sent to the electric chair. The execution caused riots in Germany, Paris, and London. On this date in 1305, William Wallace was executed for treason in London. Wallace was a Scottish hero. He had fought unsuccessfully against the English for Scottish independence. In the 14th century, a convicted traitor was typically hanged, drawn, and quartered. First, he was dragged behind a horse to the execution site, which was often some miles away. Then he was hanged until he was nearly dead, at which point he was cut down and disemboweled. His entrails were often burned in front of him. At this point, he might be beheaded. And the final step, quartering, involved tying each of his limbs to four separate horses, which were then spurred to run in opposite directions. In a history book called The History of English Law Before the Time of Edward I, reports that Wallace was drawn, that is, dragged behind a horse, for treason, hanged for robbery and homicide, disemboweled for sacrilege, beheaded for outlawry, and quartered for various depredations. And it's the birthday of Edgar Lee Masters, born in Garnet, Kansas in 1868. He grew up in small farming towns in Illinois, and he wanted to write a novel about growing up there, but he didn't know where to start. Then the editor of a poetry magazine sent him a book of poems called Selected Epigrams from the Greek Anthology, epigrams from classical Greece, many of them about the details of daily life and ordinary people. So Masters took that idea and he wrote Spoon River Anthology, in which the residents of a small Illinois town called Spoon River speak from beyond the grave and tell their life stories, more than 200 characters in all. The book became a huge success, going through 70 printings, and it changed the way Americans thought about small towns. American writers had focused almost exclusively on big cities, but Edgar Lee Masters turned small towns into places of intrigue, and American writers have been exploring the closets and bedrooms of small towns ever since. And here's a poem by Philip Larkin entitled Talking in Bed. Talking in bed ought to be the easiest. Lying together there goes back so far, an emblem of two people being honest. Yet more and more time passes silently outside the wind's incomplete unrest, builds and disperses clouds about the sky, and dark towns heap up on the horizon. None of this cares for us. Nothing shows why, at this unique distance from isolation, it becomes still more difficult to find words at once true and kind, or not untrue and not unkind. A poem by Philip Larkin entitled Talking in Bed from his collected poems published by Farrar, Straus and Giroux and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, offering poetry podcasts to listen to and thousands of poems to read at poetryfoundation.org, and by the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor, honoring the literary arts and the universe of great ideas. This is Billy Collins for the Writer's Almanac, hoping you will join us next time.
It's about 25 minutes before 4 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. And we're in the middle of a rainy afternoon with the temperatures going to hover around 60 for a little while, and then tonight it'll probably drop down to about 52. And then Saturday we're looking at more rain, and Saturday night with rain likely, and Sunday with rain likely. I'm thinking that means probably something close to rain. So that's our situation with the weather right now. My next guest is here to tell us about a program that's been in the schools for a bit and is in the schools even as we speak. Betsy Brenneman is sort of the person in charge of the BAM Activities Program, which stands for Body and Mind, right?
That's right.
And the before and after middle school.
Yeah, the kids named it. There was a contest in the spring of, let me see if I got my years right now, 2012. And the kids at both Floyd Dryden, this is a middle school program,
yeah.
So it's mainly at Floyd Dryden, it's at Floyd Dryden in Santa Kahini, and the kids had a contest, they all submitted names, and they both schools voted on the name, and BAM was the winner. So Body and Mind, before and after middle school, and that pretty much says it, because it encompasses a lot. And we are kicking off our second year of BAM, which, again, are activities that are community-based. They can happen before school in the morning, or they can happen after school in the afternoon. Kids can take the activity buses home, just like they do if they're going to participate in a school-sponsored sport. And we try to offer a real diverse array of things. So because of the cutbacks in the schools, and particularly this year, the activities budget at both the high school level and the middle school level got severely cut this year. Our need for our program is seen as even greater than it even was 4 years ago when people in the community began seeing this as a need. And so we try to offer a real diverse group of activities for kids. All activities are free. They get a healthy snack before every session of every activity. And it's right on the school grounds. So either they come to school a little early and they participate, or they just stay after school for an hour and a half. And then if they do take an activity bus, they take the activity bus home at 4:30, or they walk home as they usually would anyway. So it is the Juneau After School Coalition determined about 4 years ago that there was a real gap at the middle school age level for things for kids to do that were easily accessible after school. And that came out of this study that was done by the community about the impact of the closure of the Boys and Girls Club, which mm-hmm. happened a while ago. The national organization was deciding to close the facility here, and people were trying to figure out, well, does that matter? Does it matter? Does it matter? And so what they concluded was it matters for some kids, not enough kids who would come to the facility, but all of those kids are at school already. And I don't know if those of you out there who are familiar with any education research now, one of the big discussions going on, of course, is extending the school day and also the out-of-school, it's called OOST, out-of-school time, it's known as. And there's tons of research coming out on it. And even here in Alaska, there's quite a bit of research, recent research, on the impact at various ages of being involved in activities after school, particularly at the middle school and high school level, that reduces the risk of at-risk behaviors, all that kind of stuff that you can imagine that goes on after school before parents are home. Our coalition has done 2 years now, 3 years now, of surveys of kids at the middle schools here in Juneau, which has shown us that just under half and just over half, depending on which school you're looking at, of those kids do not have any contact with an adult of any kind after school, parent, coach, any kind of an adult in their lives, never or at most 2 days a week. So that's over half the kids of the middle school age. And this was not a particular surprise to the After School Coalition. That's what they figured they'd find. And they did find that when we did more surveys about it. So there's a real need. Kids are not engaged after school. Some kids will never be engaged after school. They just want to go hang out somewhere, and that's part of it. But what we also found in surveys we did was kids didn't know about particular activities, or they didn't want to do particular activities in the past. And so that's another reason why we are trying to do a lot of choices, make them all really accessible, make them as barrier-free as possible, and pardon me, in terms of kids participating, and also make a schedule of them so there's lots going on, and they don't all last the same length of time. It's not a set thing. We sign kids up for whatever they want to take, and if there's a limit on kids, we work that out with them. It's sort of a fluid, but it was quite successful. And last year, our first year, really, when we had activities at both Floyd Dryden and Zantakahini, we had about, let me see here. We had 21 activities between Floyd Dryden and Zantakahini total. Some repeated at both schools. Some activities happened at both schools. Some did not. And we had 287 kids attend at least once of those sessions. And we had about 220 kids attend half or more of the sessions that we offered the first year. So that's quite a few kids. And we had a lot of people step forward in the community to respond to this need, and we're looking for even more people this year to respond to the needs. I survey the kids, so I sort of keep on top of what they want to do, too. So.
What kinds of activities can a student engage in this year?
Well, this year, it's not... The schedules, it is fluid, and a lot of people who have said they're going to offer activities are still making their minds up about whether they're going to do it or not. But I can say that we are going to have the Safe Sitter babysitting training. I'm hoping to have photography again. I know we're going to have archery again. We're looking at having girls on track, which is the Girls on the Run program, but it is the middle school program. It's called Girls on Track at Middle School. They've had it at one of our middle schools, but not the others, so we'll be sponsoring that this year. We're looking at having cooking again. Cooking is a big interest, and I'm also hoping to have more art at both schools. Art is a very big interest of the kids. Flag football is one of the things we're talking about. Football is a big interest. Tennis came up on the surveys I did with kids last year. Out of the blue, tennis appeared. Cooking and art are always up there at the top. Computers, computer animation, computer games, which surprised me. I thought that would be at the top of the list always. Only for the first time at one school did it appear at the top of kids' lists. It's been on there. But that's, of course, an interest, and we're going to try to meet that with people in the community. There's everything. I mean, people could come in and do everything from chess. We're looking at, you know, getting chess going in both the schools. It was going at one of the schools after school, and now it's not going to happen this year for a variety of reasons. To kids want to do gymnastics and tumbling. They want to do dance, various kinds of dance. They've mentioned yoga. Open gym is a big one, particularly for basketball. They want to go in and play, but it's also good if somebody can be there to instruct or just give them tips or organize them a little bit. I keep thinking there are men in the community who go run before they go to work, or go to the club before they go to work, or go to a gym before they go to work and exercise. They could come to one of the two middle schools, play basketball or instruct basketball, you know, give pointers on basketball in essence, or soccer, indoor soccer, or volleyball, and go to work, and we would have a before school activity. And it's as simple as that. It can be a hobby of yours. It can also be an agency in town that wants to reach middle school kids. We're that venue. We're that platform. And I do all the recruiting of the kids. I do all the publicity. I provide the snacks. So the instructor really, they have to do some things, of course, besides the main thing they have to do is be able to relate and like being around middle school kids.
Betsy Renneman, what's the funding source for this program?
It comes from the community, really. A lot of our funding comes from the City and Borough of Juneau. We get a lot of funding from the Juneau Community Foundation. We've had support from the CrossFit Foundation, which, of course, funds projects in Southeast. The Gagin Foundation helped us get off the ground. And the UAS, the school district, people have all sort of contributed to this. We need continuing contributions. But the city this past year doubled their investment in this program. They're seeing it as a way to serve youth in a new way. Parks and Recreation, the director of that is on our executive committee, and they're seeing this as a way to, again, reach kids. The school day is so packed now that anybody who wants to go into the school and offer a class, course, even, you know, for a couple of days, it's hard to do.
Mm-hmm.
Some things do happen in the schools like that, but not as many as a lot of places in the community would like to get into the schools. Well, this after-school time, as it grows and builds, is that time for some people to do things that they would like to communicate to middle schoolers. I will again emphasize, though, that you can teach just about anything, and middle schoolers will enjoy it if you enjoy middle schoolers.
Mm-hmm.
The key is that relationship. The other key is hands-on as much as possible. Those kids really like, I've been thinking about trying to find some guys I know who could show kids how to repair a lawnmower, because a lot of them have mowing jobs in the summer. How to repair a lawnmower, how to repair a bike. We've had that, is in the works, we hope. It can be really, really simple things, and those kids really love learning those kinds of hands-on useful things.
Okay, we're just about out of time. If someone has an idea and they would like to pitch it to you for a possible inclusion in the program, how do they reach you?
They reach me at Zontakahini Middle School. My office is there, although I'm not an employee there. I am sort of. The number is 463-1899. My extension is 214. And they can also reach me through my email, which is betsy.brenneman@junoschools.org.
Okay, hey, thank you very much for telling us about the program.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. See you later.
Support for this program comes from Balloons by Night Moods, providing Juneau with new, used, and consigned party goods. Balloons by Night Moods, located at 9342 Glacier Highway in the Valley. More info at 523-1099.
As Alaskans, we face important choices about how we produce and consume energy that runs our homes and businesses. The Renewable Energy Alaska Project is committed to promoting energy efficiency and educating the public of the benefits of stably priced, clean, and local renewable energy. More information at realaska.org. This message brought to you by REAP, your voice for renewable energy.
Minutes before 4 o'clock. You're in tune with KTOO News. We're in the middle of Juneau afternoon. My next guest is coming to us from the east coast of the United States. Colonel Dave Fabian is working on a project of some note. It turns out that the U.S. Army does not have its own museum, and there have only been like regional museums around the country. Colonel Fabian is in the process of working on grant funding and will shortly, I guess, be opening the U.S. Army National Museum. Welcome, Colonel Fabian. Sir, are you with us?
I am.
Ah, hello. And I just introduced the fact that you're working on the National Museum for the Army.
That's correct.
And I understand that you've received a grant from the Alaskan Rasmussen Foundation that's going to go partially toward funding this.
That is correct. We are very pleased to have received the grant, It's going to go toward a particular sponsorship that is called the Technologies and Tactics Exhibit.
Colonel Fabian, I guess I always thought that there already was a museum for the U.S. Army. This is not true?
This is not true. There are a number of museums within the Army system. Actually, there are over 40 museums in the Army system, but they're specialty museums. They either relate to a particular particular division, like the 82nd Airborne or the 25th Infantry Division, or they apply to a particular branch of the Army, like infantry or field artillery or military police, or they're regionally associated. And we are the only service without a national museum, a comprehensive museum that would tell the Army story from 1775 to the present.
And this, where's this museum going to be?
It's going to be at Fort Belvoir, Virginia, which is about 30 minutes from the nation's capital. It's going to be along major routes, I-95. And very well located with public access, no need to go through security or anything like that.
So you obviously, if you've received a grant from the Rasmussen Foundation, your funding is not coming entirely from the U.S. Army. Why is that?
Well, actually, it's a public-private partnership, and the Army has donated the land, which is 41 acres of choice real estate on Fort Belvoir, a very nice footprint for the entire museum campus. And they are also paying for the exhibit design. We are paying for the public funds that we are getting contributions for will go toward the actual construction of the building, which is going to be 185,000 square feet and consists of three major galleries when we do open.
Colonel Fabian, then, will the those other specialty museums that you talked about, will they be closed and incorporated into the Army Museum?
No, they'll continue to exist, and the point is this will be the capstone. The National Museum will be the capstone museum for the Army, and it will serve as a central repository where we will be able to continue to service those 42 or 43 museums that we do have in other places. We're not going to cannibalize them in any way. The Army has been collecting artifacts since Congress mandated it back in 1814. The problem is they didn't appropriate any funds for the museum at the time. And so we have collected an inordinate number of personal effects and flags, standards, other types of major and minor artifacts that we have at our museum support center, which is co-located at Fort Belvoir. And so there are artifacts that the public has never seen, to include over 15,000 pieces of soldier artwork that the public has never seen. And those will be the real artifacts and historical types of artwork that will be in the museum.
As I understand, we won't need to
close down those other museums.
As I understand it, an individual soldier could actually enter his or her service into some sort of registry that will be on display in the museum.
That's correct. It's called the Registry of the American Soldier, and it's absolutely free. I know, for example, that the state of Alaska has over 30,000 surviving Army veterans, and they are all eligible. Anyone who has had Army service would be eligible to enter his service history in the registry. He can do that by going to our website, www.armyhistory.org, and going to the Soldiers Registry, entering the information along with an optional photo. And that information then will be stored when the museum is opened the kiosk that includes the honorees will be enshrined in the Soldier Stories Gallery, which is one of the three major galleries that the museum will have. And any relatives or descendants visiting the museum can go and type in the name and the service history, which would be in the words of the individual who is actually making the entry, will turn up, and you'll be able to see just what that man's contributions or that woman's contributions have been.
Colonel Fabian, how will the war dead be honored in this museum?
Well, there are a number of ways that this will occur. We have a path of remembrance. This is for individuals. It's a commemorative brick program, and both living and deceased members of the Army, dating all the way back to 1775, would be eligible for enrollment there. And then throughout the museum, there will be specific locations where individuals will be honored.
Assuming that someone would like to see their a family member honored who had served in the military, how would they contact the museum to participate in that?
Again, everything would be available at our website, www.armyhistory.org, and it would give specific information for either the registry or for donating personal artifacts or for serving as a grassroots volunteer for the museum. It's quite an extensive list of opportunities to get individuals recognized as well as to assist us in our efforts.
Will there be, is this to be a standing collection, or will there be changing exhibits of various kinds in the museum over time, or how have you are you to the point of planning that sort of thing yet?
Well, we have the original plan for the museum 95% complete, but there is a contingency plan to change out various exhibits downrange once the museum has been established and, you know, we've had an appropriate number of visitors to where we might be getting repeats. And there's also a plan that we mentioned those other 43 museums. There'll be an opportunity to change out something that we may have and send it down to Fort Benning or, you know, Fort Bragg, North Carolina, or up to Richardson or whatever. And one of their exhibits would come in on an exchange basis.
Sir, this sounds like a really amazing opportunity for people to participate in the formation of the museum because of the timing. This is exactly the time when if someone wants to honor one of their loved ones or to enter their own service record into the museum, that's all possible. Are you also looking for individuals to support the ongoing construction effort?
Yes, we are. We have our contributions are coming from corporate America, from foundations like the Rasmussen Foundation, and also from individuals across the country. We have so far over 110,000 individual contributors to the museum, and those are contributions that come anywhere from 25 to, actually, we have a couple of seven-figure donors to the program to date. The museum is going to cost $175 million to open, and we are at the $73 million mark right now. So there is great interest in the museum on the part of individuals and as well as corporate America and foundations like the one in Alaska here.
Colonel Dave Fabian, I wish you very good luck in continuing to build the U.S. Army National Museum, and thank you so much for bringing us up to date on this. Congratulations on your Rasmussen grant.
And thank you very much. We appreciate the opportunity to share the information with your listeners.
Good afternoon, sir.
So thank you. Bye-bye.
You're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Be sure you tune in tomorrow to Juneau Afternoon. We'll have Bill Pollack from the Juneau Brass and Winds on here. Andy Hirsch and Sherry Patterson will come in to highlight Wednesday's celebration of the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech. Laura Downs will be here with cellist Sewell Bailey, and we'll hear about how to speak Chinese with guest Laurie Thompson. You're in tune with KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. We also broadcast on translators throughout the area. K276 AF, 103.1 in the Valley and Auk Bay. Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus hears us on K201 AM 88.1. K220 BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. And in Excursion Inlet in Icy Strait, it's K210 AS at 89.9. Pat Moore, thank you very much for listening to Juneau Afternoon today.